On Sunday, May 11, 1997, at approximately 6:25 a.m., the Toronto Fire Department was toned out for a structure fire at a home in Toronto, Ohio. That home belonged to 86-year-old Ruth Roberts. Ruth, born on December 25, 1910, was an elder and deacon in her church. She taught Sunday school, and she was, by all accounts, a loving and caring person. In a statement, firefighter Christopher Grimm describes how Ruth was found on that day in May 1997. She was lying on the floor of one of the bedrooms in her house. She was on her back, naked from the waist down, and was positioned between a bed and a wall. Ruth Roberts, a caring, loving, elderly woman, was dead. When her body was brought out of the house, Mr. Grimm observed blood coming from her mouth. He also noted that her face was bruised and swollen. An autopsy performed by Dr. Himanshu Doshi would later reveal the extent of Ruth's injuries. She had rib fractures, she had broken skull bones. Also, her body had been burned post-mortem. She had died of, quote, extensive blunt force traumatic injuries to the skull, neck, and chest. Ruth's three killers were later apprehended and sent to prison. They were Dan McCauley, 16, Jerry Lee White, 16, and Clifford Mount, 14. McCauley has since died. I believe he killed himself. So this leaves only White and Mount, both of whom previously had parole hearings scheduled for around 2042. Fast forward to 2021. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine signs into law Senate Bill 256, which I think is better called the Teen Killer Empowerment Act, or TKEA for short. The TKEA cut Mounts and White sentences substantially and could put them back on the streets very soon. Keep listening to learn about the law that could set Ruth's killers free and how you can help victims and their families fight against it.
You are listening to the Roberta Glass True Crime Report, putting the true back in true crime. From New York City, Roberta Glass is now on the record.
Hello everyone, this is Jane from the National Organization of Victims of Juvenile Murderers. I'm making a guest episode, or gepisode as I call it, for Roberta's channel. This gepisode is about the Ohio Senate Bill 256, which I call the Ohio Teen Killer Empowerment Act, and the offenders it rewards. Specifically, I will examine the murder of Ruth Roberts and how inaccurate claims about her killer, Clifford Mounts, were used to promote the Teen Killer Empowerment Act. Now, what does the Teen Killer Empowerment Act do, and how does it affect Ruth Roberts' killers? The Teen Killer Empowerment Act gives special parole privileges for almost all juvenile criminals in Ohio. Now, when I use the term juvenile criminal, juvenile offender, or juvenile felon, I'm talking about someone who is serving a sentence for criminal activity they committed as a juvenile. So this term includes those who are now adults but are incarcerated for crimes they committed as minors. Mount, for example, was 14 when he killed Ruth, and he is now, I believe, around 40. So he is not a juvenile anymore, but he is in prison for a crime he committed as a juvenile. So he is a juvenile criminal. Actually, he's not just a juvenile criminal, he is a juvenile murderer because he committed murder as a juvenile. Anyway, the Teen Killer Empowerment Act gave this murderer a parole hearing in 2022. Mounts was denied parole and will be up for parole again in 2027. If you are watching this video, there is a chance that you have heard about the Ohio Teen Killer Empowerment Act in previous episodes. I did a guest episode where I explained in detail what it does and why NOVJM opposes it. I also did an interview with Roberta and Brian Kirk. Brian is the grandson of Marie Bill Castro, whose murderer, Jacob LaRosa, is rewarded by the Teen Killer Empowerment Act. It's a great episode, and Brian's a great guy, and he did a great job explaining who his grandmother was and how this bill has completely re-victimized his entire family. The Ohio Teen Killer Empowerment Act retroactively abolishes life without parole, or LWOP, for almost all juvenile criminals. It mandates the following. Parole eligibility after no more than 18 years for juveniles who commit non-homicide crimes. Parole eligibility after no more than 25 years for juveniles who are the principal offender in one murder. And parole eligibility after no more than 30 years for juveniles who are the principal offender in two murders. Under the Teen Killer Empowerment Act, juveniles who act as the principal offender in three or more murders can receive LWOP. Now, you might be wondering, why does a juvenile have to kill three people before LWOP can be available? Aren't two murders enough? Isn't one murder enough? The goal behind the Teen Killer Empowerment Act is to benefit every single juvenile criminal in Ohio, except T.J. Lane. Lane is perhaps Ohio's most notorious juvenile murderer. At 17, he committed a school shooting that left three people dead, and he was later sentenced to life without parole. Before the Teen Killer Empowerment Act, Ohio lawmakers had attempted to pass other bills aimed at requiring parole chances for juvenile offenders. These bills would have made Lane parole eligible, resulting in public backlash. They failed. When SB 256 was introduced, it included a triple homicide exception to avoid the controversy caused by the previous juvenile parole bills. It doesn't take a genius to see that SB 256 is poorly written. Under 256, someone like New Mexico's Nathaniel Jewett, who killed two people and injured four during a mass shooting, could not get LWOP. Apparently, murdering two and wounding four just isn't severe enough. So this is what happens when support for violent criminals gets in the way of reason. While rewarding rapists and murderers based on their birthdays, the TKEA has devastated victims who now must endure traumatic and painful parole hearings that were never supposed to happen or were supposed to happen later on. This re-victimization is completely unnecessary. The Supreme Court has ruled that LWOP is okay for juvenile murderers as long as it is discretionary. In fact, days after the TKEA went into effect, SCOTUS again upheld juvenile LWOP in Jones v. Mississippi. Now let's discuss the murder of Ruth Roberts. When SB 256 was going through the legislative process, there were committee hearings held on it. Supporters of Mounts testified in favor of the Teen Killer Empowerment Act at those committee hearings. One of these supporters is Mounts' father. The other is a lobbyist. Now, that's all I'm going to share with you about them. I'm not even going to say their names, because I don't really care about who they are. My focus is on what they claimed and how it compares to the information I found when looking through the case file. I'm going to show you what one of those supporters said in his oral testimony, and then I'm going to take you through the case file, and we are going to compare them. Here we have testimony given by a lobbyist supporter of SB 256 in front of the Ohio House Criminal Justice Committee. This video of this testimony is on the Ohio channel, and just so the audience knows, I had to listen to the speech and transcribe it so that I could share it with you and not get in trouble for using Ohio channel audio, because I don't know the rules about sharing that on YouTube. Anyway, this was a very cringy, painful task, and I feel like I almost broke my neck cringing because it was that bad. This is one of the worst things I've ever listened to. Let's just go through this. This lobbyist tells the House Criminal Justice Committee that Cliff has been incarcerated since 1997 and that he went into the system at the age of 14. Quote, Cliff was 14 and his two accomplices were 16. They brought a gun. They kind of threatened Cliff. End quote. This man goes on to claim that the 16-year-olds convinced Cliff that if he didn't help them, they were going to rob Cliff and Cliff's family. The lobbyist continues. He says, quote, he kind of goes along with this. He meaning Cliff. They think that the elderly neighbor isn't home, and of course the worst possible thing that could have happened is that she was home, and in the course of this botched robbery, she's killed. The kids think it's a good idea to light the house on fire to cover their tracks, and so you add aggravated arson. End quote. This gentleman claims that local authorities wanted to make an example out of Cliff. He says that right before the trial, Cliff was brought into a room and he was told that if he didn't take a plea deal, he would spend the rest of his life in prison. And so he agreed to a 43-year-to-life sentence as part of the plea deal. So that is what was presented to the Ohio House Criminal Justice Committee. And this is just one time where this story was presented to an Ohio legislative committee. Cliff and these other juvenile killers that 256 is going to benefit, they're the real victims. The people they murdered and those people's families, well, they don't really matter. Let's just forget about them and focus on helping these poor darling murderers. Anyways, let's look at what the case file says about Clifford Mounts. As explained in the beginning of this episode, Ruth Roberts was an 86-year-old woman who was found murdered in her home. Three killers were Jerry White, Dan McCauley, and Clifford Mounts. Based on the case file, I think it is fair to say that Mounts was the most violent and cruel of this murderous trio. Clifford Mounts actually lived next door to Ruth, and he knew her. In fact, Ruth was known in the small Toronto, Ohio community to have been very kind to Mounts and his family. Mounts himself told Captain Emmett Mosty of the Toronto Police Department, quote, how nice the lady was to him and his family, end quote. Mounts' dad told police that his kids called Ruth Grandma. Investigators noted that Mounts' bedroom was 10 feet from the fire in Ruth's house. They also noted that he stated how nice Ruth was to him and his family, but showed no concern or sympathy about the fire and wasn't inquisitive. So now let's move on, and investigators are going to interview Mounts. They Mirandized him orally and in writing in the presence of his father, and Mounts admitted that he and Jerry White had discussed burglarizing Ruth's home. He admitted to taking a gray sweatshirt and using it to wipe off items he had touched so that he would not leave fingerprints. He also admitted that he had kicked Ruth in the head. This was confirmed by forensic testing. Linda Eveleth of the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Identification and Investigation found that both shoes belonging to Mounts were presumptive positive for human blood. Now let's go to what White and McCauley said. White and McCauley were both taken into custody and gave statements. I believe that McCauley gave verbal statements and White gave written and verbal statements. White, quote, appeared to be truthful, end quote. McCauley was, quote, truthful with his verbal statement and showed signs of remorse, end quote. White said, quote, Dan and I got a beer buyer, then we walked to Cliff's, knocked on his window. He answered and let us in. We drank and Cliff said that he knew an easy way into the house, so we went over, end quote. That was Ruth Roberts' house that he's talking about. McCauley talks in his statements about going to Mount's house with beer, going in through the bedroom window, and then drinking beer with Mounts. He says that Mounts said, quote, we can rob old lady next door because she is deaf, end quote. So this trio went to Ruth's house, and from that point on, it's going to get really, really disturbing. Both McCauley and White stated that White broke the plastic screen to enter Ruth's house. They both talk about how, after they had entered Ruth's home, White tried to hit her, but missed. I'm not going to go into the details of exactly what they each said about every single thing that happened in that house. I want to focus on White and McCauley said about Mounts. According to White's statement, quote, Cliff was jumping from the drawer onto her and Dan kicked her. I kicked her and we started searching again. Then Cliff and Dan put her on the bed. Dan and I searched the bathroom and Cliff put a pillow over her face and put his foot in her throat, end quote. McCauley stated, quote, then Cliff was jumping off the dresser onto her head and body. I said, don't kill her. Every time Cliff would jump on her, I could hear snapping. Cliff and I picked her up and put her on the bed. Then Cliff put a pillow over her head and then took his foot and shoved it against her throat. End quote. McCauley also says that every time Mounts would jump on Ruth, she would moan or scream. So both McCauley and White say pretty much the same thing about what Mounts did to Ruth. Let's talk now about some statements made by jail inmates who spoke to McCauley, White, and Mounts. Jason Martin is one inmate who gave a statement about what these guys told him. Martin says, quote, Danny and Jerry Lee White told me that Cliff Mounts was jumping on the lady's chest off a dresser. Cliff Mounts told me that Jerry Lee White was into the house first, and Danny McCauley said pop her, and Jerry hit her in the face and she fell, and Danny came over and hit the lady, and Danny said they left the room and came back, and Cliff was jumping onto her chest, end quote. Robert Liggett is another inmate. He gave written statements on September 2nd, 1997, in which he explained what the murderers told him. He talks about how he was told that the three boys broke into the victim's house. He was told Jerry punched out the window and unlocked the door. The three entered the house, and the woman, Ruth, came out of the bedroom and started screaming. So Dan told Jerry to knock her out. Jerry swung at her but missed and hit his face on the wall. Dan then punched her. She fell to the floor, and Dan proceeded to kick her. That's what Robert Liggett says happened, based on what he was told by the murderers themselves. Liggett also explains Mount's part in all this. Liggett was told that White and McCauley went through the house searching for valuables and money. When they were in the back bedroom, they heard loud bangs on the floor upstairs. They ran into the room where they saw Cliff Mounts getting ready to jump off the dresser onto the woman. End quote. Liggett also spoke to Mounts himself. What does he say? Well, I'm just going to read a direct quote from a statement made on September 2nd, 1997 by Liggett. Quote, "One day I decided to ask Cliff Mounts what he was thinking and what he did in this murder/robbery. He proceeded to tell me much of which Dan and Jerry told me before. He also told me that he was the one and only to jump off the dresser onto the woman. He then told me that he couldn't remember everything because he was messed up on crack. He did say that his reason for jumping on the woman was because he said she had seen his face and he figured that she would be able to identify him." Mounts is telling Liggett what White and McCauley had said to police and other inmates. Why would Mounts lie and say that he had jumped off the dresser onto Ruth if he actually didn't do that? Was he forced by McCauley and White to say this? Is Liggett part of the conspiracy? Did Liggett lie and say that Mounts said something that Mounts in fact never said? Let's move on to Robert Reeves. Robert Reeves was a corrections officer for the Jefferson County Juvenile Court. He worked at Stratton Detention Center and met Mounts. Reeves overheard Mounts talking to a cellmate. He heard Mounts talk about kicking Ruth. Reeves also stated, quote, "I've had other juveniles come up to me and tell me in graphic detail what Cliff had told them. Based on what they told me, it sounded like he played more of a role in the attack on Ruth Roberts," end quote. So was this corrections officer lying? Did the inmates he spoke to lie? Did he mishear those other inmates? And did he mishear Mounts? What's going on here? I'm going to end with a statement by Jeff Emery, who was in the Stratton Detention Center. I'm going to read you his statement. As I do this, ask yourself if it sounds familiar. Jeff Emery says, quote, "When I was in Stratton, Cliff Mounts tried to get me to say that he had a gun pulled on him by Jerry White, and that Jerry said, 'If you don't go into the house, I will kill you.' Cliff had a story all planned out, that when Jerry White first came in, I asked him what he was in there for, and he said homicide. Then when me and Jerry was talking, I asked why Cliff went over there, and Jerry said I pulled a gun on him and made Cliff do it. This was a plan that Cliff wanted me to say to try to get Cliff off of murder," end quote. So this should sound familiar to you. This is the version of events that was repeated to the Ohio House Criminal Justice Committee. As Prosecutor Chris Becker points out in his letter to the parole board opposing parole for Mounts, no one ever found the gun that was supposedly used to threaten Mounts. No one mentioned it until Mounts realized the severity of his charges and that he would be prosecuted as an adult. By the way, Chris prosecuted this case, and he also prosecuted SB 256 beneficiary Jacob LaRosa. Anyway, Mounts pleaded guilty. He could have gone to trial to present his claim of coercion. He didn't. Now, the gentleman that we saw testify claimed that Mounts was, I guess, kind of bullied into taking the 43-to-life plea deal. But does that story make sense? If everything this gentleman says about Mounts and his involvement in the murder of Ruth is true, then 43 years to life is an insanely overly harsh sentence. Remember, according to this story, Mounts was threatened with a gun and told that if he didn't participate in the robbery, he and his family would be robbed. So 43 to life would be way disproportionate to his acts. I can understand the idea of a 14-year-old becoming involved in a terrible agreement which involves them completing an extremely overly harsh sentence, but what about Mount's parents and his uncles and aunts and all the adults in his life? No reasonable adult would agree to a 43 to life sentence for a 14-year-old who was threatened into participating in a robbery that resulted in death, especially when they have the option of going to trial and proving their case. If the coercion story is true, why wouldn't they be willing to argue that true story to a jury? Wouldn't there be evidence they could present to back up their story? Again, the person who gave this false story to the Ohio House Criminal Justice Committee was probably not intentionally lying. Still, I mean, the fact that this false story was shared with the legislative committee is just extremely upsetting. This false claim was used to promote a bill that would ultimately devastate the lives of countless victims and victims' family members. And my goal is not to shame him for spreading false information, but I am going to expose the misinformation that was shared with legislative committees. And notice that I said misinformation, because that's what this was. There's a difference between intentionally lying and unintentionally spreading false information. The former is worse than the latter. I'm not going to go into someone's head and assume their thoughts or their motivation or their intent. I am simply pointing out that what he said in his testimony in this hearing is not consistent with the facts as shown by witness statements, forensic testing, police reports, and so on. This was not even the only time that this false narrative about Mounts was shared with Ohio legislators during a committee hearing. This is just the one that I'm focusing on for this episode. Now, when it comes to the Teen Killer Empowerment Act and other felon-friendly legislation, victims and their families are underdogs. Victims have not been treated well by advocates of juvenile murderers around the country. They completely disregard her concerns. For example, Evelyn Stratton is a former Ohio Supreme Court justice. She supports 256. Now in 2021, Brian Kirk, Murray Belcastro's grandson, did a press tour and gave several press conferences around the state about his opposition to the Teen Killer Empowerment Act. We got a lot of news coverage during that tour, and I assume that's how Judge Stratton learned of victim opposition to 256. So she wrote an op-ed explaining her support for it. She starts the op-ed stating, quote, "Ohio law does not ban severe and long sentences for juveniles. Families need to understand what SB 256 really does, and I write to set the record straight," end quote. Now this statement is very condescending and dismissive. It implies that the Teen Killer Empowerment Act doesn't really harm victims and their families, and that they only oppose it because they don't understand what it does. This is inaccurate. The victims I've been working with, who are affected by 256, do understand what it does. Some, like Brian, have read the entire bill. I have read the entire bill. We oppose it for legitimate reasons, not because we misunderstand it. The TKEA requires frequent parole chances for juvenile criminals, including the most violent, depraved, and evil criminals in the state of Ohio. Like Gavin Ramsey, who strangled 98-year-old Margaret Douglas to death and then sexually assaulted her body. And Jacob LaRosa, who tried to rape 94-year-old Marie Belcastro and beat her to death with a heavy metal flashlight. And Clint Dickens, who kidnapped and raped college girls Don McCreary and Wendy Afredo, and then beat and strangled them to death to eliminate them as witnesses. A lot of survivors have legitimate fears that if their victimizer is released, they will harm them again. Maybe they helped get the offender apprehended, prosecuted, and sent to prison, like they reported the offender's crimes, identified them to police, testified against them in trial. So if the offender is free from prison, they could retaliate against the survivor for helping the criminal justice system hold them accountable. And some victims fear the release of their victimizer because that offender explicitly said they would harm them again if released from prison. And maybe they sent threatening letters from within prison or threatened them in the courtroom. 256 forces victims to live with the agonizing, debilitating fear that their victimizer will be released early and harm them again. To defend their safety, they are forced to speak up during the parole process and try to convince the parole board not to endanger them by releasing the assailant. A lot of survivors don't just fear for themselves, they fear for other people. Survivors have a unique understanding of the danger the criminal that harmed them poses. They are obligated to share that with the parole board and prevent the criminal from being released and harming others the way they harmed them. There's also the matter of justice. Victims want to ensure that the criminal who harmed them and their family is held accountable and faces a consequence that is proportionate to their crime. A lot of victims feel that early release from prison would demean the crime. So victims speak up at these parole hearings to preserve justice and prevent the criminal from harming them and others. And during those parole hearings is torture. When one goes through this, they relive the crime, they have nightmares, they have flashbacks. It's terrible. The system is basically ripping the stitches out of their wounds, tearing their wounds open, and pouring lemon juice and salt into them. I've personally seen murder victims' families endure parole hearings that were brought about by the Teen Killer Empowerment Act. I saw how reliving the crime at those parole hearings devastated them. So for Judge Stratton to imply that, you know, victims and their families oppose 256 because they just misunderstand it, is just one of the most dismissive things I've ever seen. She also writes, "I write to set the record straight," end quote. So basically, victims and their families and their advocates are a bunch of ignorant, uneducated people who just need an enlightened person like her to explain to us why we're wrong and why our concerns are illegitimate and why we are just unappreciative of the gift that 256 is. How condescending. That's just one example. We wrote a letter to the editor in response, and we said that we would be glad to speak with Justice Stratton and any SB 256 proponents to find a middle ground. We never heard back from her. Supporters of juvenile murderers also use hurtful propaganda that demeans victims' experiences. For example, someone wrote in testimony in favor of the Teen Killer Empowerment Act, quote, "Children make mistakes, head down wrong paths, and sometimes find themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. We must consider the whole person, the child who is often a product of his or her environment, and who often lacks the cognitive function to reason as an adult should. We must believe in our young people. We must believe that our children can be rehabilitated and lead productive lives despite their mistakes," end quote. This person ends their testimony by saying, quote, In closing, I would like to encourage the committee to help restore these young people who made mistakes as children and to consider their unique circumstances at every possible moment. End quote. First of all, the word mistake implies that an offender did not intend or foresee the consequences of their actions. But the criminals that the Teen Killer Empowerment Act benefits did intend and understand the consequences of their evil actions. So describing their crimes as mistakes downplays the offender's culpability. The use of the term child to advocate for leniency for violent teens is also inappropriate. Most juveniles in Ohio who get life and long sentences were 16 or 17 when they committed their crimes. The term child, however, is most often used to describe pre-adolescent youth, which is adolescence generally is considered to begin around age 12. The term child is associated with innocence, vulnerability to harm, kindness, and other characteristics that are common among actual pre-adolescent children. Teenage rapists and murderers do not display these characteristics. They are not vulnerable to harm. They cause harm. Many of them, like Jacob LaRosa and Gavin Ramsey, target elderly or other types of vulnerable people. Rapists and murderers certainly are not innocent or kind. They don't have the traits that you're trying to associate them with. When people hear the word child, they picture a 60-pound elementary school-aged kid playing tag on a playground, not a 17-year-old 200-pound rapist. By referring to 15, 16, and 17-year-old violent felons as children, juvenile killer supporters paint a false image, emotionally manipulate people. Vicious criminals like Jacob LaRosa should not be associated with innocence and other childhood qualities that they do not possess. Think about it. If you were being raped at gunpoint by a 175-pound, 6-foot, 17-year-old male, would you think of the attacker as a child or a kid? Here's another example. In a Columbus Dispatch article titled SB 256 Gives Young Defendants a Chance to Turn Their Lives Around, the author says, quote, "Justice-involved children deserve love, mercy, forgiveness, and the support they need to change their future," end quote. First, whether or not to forgive a violent felon is not up to some activist or lobbyist or parole board member. It can only come from the people the violent felon has harmed. People who are unconnected to the crimes have no business demanding forgiveness. Some survivors do choose to forgive, like Brian Kirk, who forgives his grandma's murderer, Jacob LaRosa. And that's fine, but some victims and their families choose not to forgive, and both choices should be respected. Apparently, according to this article, violent criminals are the real victims who society owes a favor to. It is our job to reward them. Victims, however, can be tormented, re-victimized, and sacrificed to the altar of violent criminals. Notice that this person called juvenile murderers, like Jacob LaRosa, justice-involved children. Justice-involved youth and justice-involved children are a common buzzword that we see. But murderers, rapists, and other violent felons are not justice involved. They're not involved in justice. Murder is legally recognized as the greatest injustice there is. One who commits these crimes is involved in injustice and is the opposite of a justice-involved person. What this term means is justice system involved, as in involved in the justice system. And violent criminals are involved in the justice system, or at least they should be. But they are involved in that system because of their own violent, felonious choices. They didn't just unwillingly become involved in the justice system for no reason. Referring to them as being justice system involved or justice involved makes it sound like these are just normal teens who got involved with the justice system. They didn't actually do anything to get involved in the justice system. The system kind of just swept them up. Again, this is a euphemism meant to demean crimes and minimize accountability. I could go on and on and on about how advocates of juvenile murderers use horrible propaganda to advance their cause. I mean, they use pictures of 7-year-old child models when, again, most of the killers they're trying to free were 16 or 17 when they committed their crimes. This stuff has all been discussed on the show before, and I encourage you to watch those episodes. Now, to supporters of SB 256 and other similar juvenile parole bills, how do you think murder victims' families feel when you say that the brutal murder of their loved one was a mistake? How do you think a rape victim feels when you portray the 180-pound 17-year-old male who overpowered her and used his physical strength to rape her as a child who got involved in the justice system? How do you think one feels when families of T.J. Lane's victims are allowed the legal finality and justice of LWOP because of the notoriety attached to their case? But even though your loved one's murder was just as horrific as Lane's crimes, your family is denied the justice and sense of closure that LWOP gives because your story just isn't high profile enough. Do you think that these bills and the tactics used to promote them are fair to victims and their families? Do you think that Ohio victims are being treated well? Or can we all acknowledge that demeaning people's experiences with euphemisms like justice involved youth, re-victimizing them with relentless painful parole hearings, and devaluing them for not getting as much attention as T.G. Lane, you know, maybe is not kind, compassionate, or fair? This is what people who have lost loved ones to juvenile murderers have to deal with around the country, in Ohio, in New Mexico, all over the place. And it would be nice if our concerns and rights would be considered, but they're just not. So if you're listening to this, go ahead and visit ohiocsf.com and teenkillers.org. Also, sign our change.org petition, which is linked below, and watch our other videos on Roberta's channel. Like I said, we're underdogs. You know, I'm not a former state Supreme Court judge. I'm not the head of some organization. I'm not a professional lobbyist. I'm not a legislator. I'm just a normal person who saw the pro-murder movement and decided to get involved and help innocent people who are being re-victimized by people that care more about criminals than them. I'm very thankful for Roberta for allowing me to have a voice and share the experiences of the people I've worked with. And thank you, Roberta, for allowing others to have a voice. Go ahead and subscribe to this channel as well. Thank you very much for listening.